I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
In just a few short days, we will be back with season two of Impolite Company, listeners. We can hardly wait, and we know that you have a few things on your minds as well. Apparently, there's a pastor out there destroying Nike gear from the pulpit, because that'll show him. And apparently, the Catholic Church is in an all-out civil war.
But in the meantime, we wanted to give you a taste of the new season by bringing you this conversation I had with evangelical historian Kristen Dumais of Calvin College. Kristen is a history and gender studies professor, and she's one of the most interesting voices in the evangelical world right now, left, right, or center.
She spent much of her career studying American evangelicals, and she's just finished writing a book about evangelical masculinity and militarism that we cannot wait to read. Amy and Kristen talked about white evangelical support for Trump and why it's less about hypocrisy or a transactional relationship than it is about a toxic, aggressive theological and cultural worldview.
The regular pod will return soon with a few new features as well as all your favorites. I think we all need a cathartic airing of 3 minutes of Nish.
Yeah, for sure.
But for now, here's my interview with Kristen Dumais.
Kristen, thank you so much for being able to join us for this episode. So you may have actually been keyed into something that most of us missed, and that I, during the 2016 election, kept waiting for everybody to comment on, which is I would listen to Trump talking before evangelical groups. And I think the first major meeting was supposed to be a private gathering in New York in June of 2016. And it was evangelical leaders. And we got audio snuck out of the meeting for us at Yahoo. So I listened to the whole thing, was transcribing it, and was just struck by how blunt Trump's appeals were to evangelicals. Maybe it's because I've been writing for so many years about faith outreach on the Democratic side, where politicians have to be so careful about landmines and using the right language and being sufficiently respectful. And here's this guy who just kind of blunders in, and it's like, I love the evangelicals. The evangelicals have been good for me. You are under threat and I'm going to save you. And I just thought, this is the lamest appeal. They're going to be offended by how easy he thinks they are to win over. And not yet. From then up until just within the last couple of weeks, when they had evangelicals into the White House for a supposed quasi-state dinner for them, his appeal hasn't gotten any more sophisticated than that. And I think he assumes, perhaps rightly, it doesn't have to get more sophisticated than that because he got their support and they're not going anywhere.
Right, right. It has worked extremely well for him. And you're right, he was extremely blunt. And he actually kind of came to this wooing of evangelicals rather late in the game in terms of the campaign season. But he was already, before he was explicitly and bluntly reaching out and making promises of Supreme Court appointments and saying how much he liked evangelicals, he was already garnering some significant evangelical support during the primary season. And as I, as an observer, kind of wrestled with understanding this and his appeal to evangelicals, I really had to get over this kind of hypocrisy notion, because that was kind of the easy example or the easy analysis, right? That these evangelicals are such hypocrites. And there's an element there. They extend lavish grace to Trump. And that's really a motif that you hear over and over again, including last week at the evangelical state dinner. Just, you know, God has so much grace for Donald Trump, and they are going to lavish that on him. Of course, that grace did not extend to a lot of others. Just ask the Clintons or LGBT folks, and, you know, the list goes on. So hypocrisy is kind of one explanatory trope. or this kind of transactional politics of, and there's evidence for that. Certainly Trump speaks in that transactional language, and evangelical leaders and some evangelical rank and file will talk about that too. He gives us this, we hold our noses and tolerate him. But the more I listened and the more I watched, I just didn't see a lot of pained nose holding. It didn't seem like for many evangelicals, it was a huge struggle to take the plunge and support Trump. And I think to understand that, we have to look at affinities. That, again, they're not just holding their noses because he's going to do something that they think is really important, even if that's the language they use and even if that's part of the story. But let's take family values, for example, because that's the place where I think Trump probably, arguably, most clearly contradicts what we might think are evangelical values when it comes to his personal morality. But if you scratch just beneath the surface of family values politics, you'll see that it's not just this kind of vague, wholesome, keeping families together, marriage kind of thing. Evangelical family values are deeply rooted in the idea of authority, specifically patriarchal authority, and closely related to that, gender difference. And when you look at what they think men should be and what they think women should be and do, women are to submit to male authority. And evangelical ideas, not all evangelical ideas of masculinity, but very popular evangelical views of masculinity have long, I'm talking decades here, celebrated a kind of aggressive masculinity, kind of rough testosterone-driven masculinity that has been deemed God-given, right? God made men to with testosterone, and essential to protect women and children, and to protect our country. They've really kind of created a Jesus in this image of testosterone-driven masculinity. So it's they'll go so far as to, you know, reject this idea of turn the other cheek. No. That's not appropriate. Not when we're in this dangerous time, when we're under siege, when our nation and our faith and our families are under threat. For times such as these, we need an aggressive leader, a strong man. And when you look at that language that has really been pervasive in evangelical popular literature for decades, suddenly there's not such a leap between evangelical values and the kind of leadership that we see in somebody like Trump.
That is fascinating. And it actually provides an answer to something I've wondered about for a while, which is one of the few times that I felt like Trump gave just a completely unvarnished, honest answer in the area of faith. I think it was an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network a few years ago. It was during the campaign. He was asked what his favorite Bible verse was. And he said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And I started reporting that out. And everybody I talked to said, I've never heard anybody identify that as their favorite verse for good reason. You know, the traditional Jewish understanding is that it was setting out kind of the limits of a punishment, that you couldn't extract more than a certain amount in terms of vengeance for something when you felt you'd been wronged. But also most Christians know that that was one of the few verses that Jesus actually explicitly calls out and rebukes and says, you have heard it said an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So the idea that this is somebody's like guiding verse just seems absurd, except if you understand evangelicals in this way that you've just laid out.
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, many of his strongest supporters are preaching this kind of militant masculinity. So Liberty University's Jerry Falwell Jr. absolutely embraces this. His father, Jerry Falwell Sr., was one of the leading proponents of this militant masculinity. Robert Jeffress, a great example, as he so eloquently put it, "I want the meanest, toughest son of a you-know-what," and I think that's where many evangelicals are, again, because of these perceived threats. And this also, when you're working from out of this framework, then a lot of Trump's character flaws are not necessarily, they certainly aren't unforgivable sins, and they aren't even such flaws, right? Because if you've got a lot of masculinity or a lot of testosterone, sexual escapades here or there, well, you know, they're going to happen. Or his lack of quote unquote political correctness, his, saying the wrong thing, blundering, his bluntness, all of this can kind of be seen as, wow, he's a tough guy. And that's really what we need right now. And so it covers over a multitude of what might otherwise be perceived as sins or character flaws.
So this may be getting a little inside baseball with evangelicals, but talk to me just a little bit about how we reconcile this kind of aggressive masculine Christianity with the aesthetic that a fair number of conservative evangelicals have cultivated in the last few decades of the pastor who's kind of a personality and down to earth and wears his jeans and his hip haircut and is supposed to at least project a more metrosexual, gentler approach.
Yeah. Like the skinny jeans have replaced the khakis and polo shirts now for the evangelical dress code. It's interesting. You do have multiple Christian masculinities at play in any given time and even in any given community. The guy you're describing in terms of appearance, that would have been a perfect description for somebody like Mark Driscoll 10 years ago, right? Who was this kind of hip, new generation, emergent church leader, but he was also really one of the leading proponents of this very harsh militant masculinity and everything that went with it. So the two are not mutually exclusive, but if I could do a little bit of psychologizing here, which I'm not really qualified to do, I've thought a lot about this. And I wonder if on some level there isn't some compensation going on here. I feel like evangelical men have really struggled with this. And so you'll have evangelical men writing books that are literally titled "No More Mr. Nice Guy," right? That they kind of feel like Christian teachings are on the one hand pulling them to be nice, to be seeker friendly, to be hip, to be all these things, and yet these are the very people that are sometimes then drawn to a very militant version of masculinity. And even if they aren't living it out in their own lives necessarily, they may be more prone to embrace it when it comes to an ideal of leadership, when it comes to questions of foreign policy. That's one of the things I really explore in my research, is how this ideology really situates evangelicals in very explicit ways to embrace kind of preemptive war, aggressive foreign policy, condone the use of torture, and absolutely embrace the military. And that's been a theme that's been very prominent in popular evangelical literature on masculinity since the 1970s, actually. And so I think that, you know, it can be on a personal level, but many evangelical men are not, you know, living out the Mel Gibson Braveheart in their daily lives. And yet I think they feel that somehow that is true manly Christianity. And they want to participate in that, even if not directly.
So it strikes me that even setting aside any policy differences that a lot of conservative evangelicals had with Hillary Clinton and any history, you know, and there's a long, complicated history of how evangelicals feel about Hillary, but that there were a whole cross-section of evangelicals who are not going to be willing to accept the idea of a woman, any woman, as president.
Yeah, so a really interesting comparative study is Sarah Palin versus Hillary Clinton, right? And we do have data that suggests that for a certain subset of white evangelicals, they will not accept a woman as president. It does not fit with their notions of gendered authority. Now, when Sarah Palin came along, some of the more conservative evangelicals really struggled with that. And they came to the conclusion that she would be okay, even though not ideal, that Obama would be much, 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 much worse. And so they could make an exception for her. But what I would also say is that Sarah Palin, as a woman, and the kind of femininity that she embodied, was one that was largely consistent with the larger evangelical worldview. So she was, you know, the former beauty queen, and she was irreverent, and she certainly embraced a kind of militant foreign policy, a kind of reckless demeanor that in some ways she was a harbinger of Trump, really, but the feminine side. And so she was really, I think, in some ways, a dangerous person if you're a liberal, because she could so effectively work within that reigning ideology. Hillary Clinton, she was about the worst possible candidate in terms of for people who embrace this ideology. And like you say, she has a long history with evangelicals, and evangelicals have a long history of demonizing Hillary Clinton. And in part, that's because she represented a threat to their entire gender system. Early on, I'm sure you remember the Cookiegate controversy, where she said she wasn't going to stay home and bake cookies and so on. But, you know, it wasn't that comment that turned evangelicals against her. It was really what she represented as a threat to the gender roles that they thought were really critical to social order and to the well-being of families and of the nation. So no, Hillary Clinton would not have won them over, policy matters aside. But of course, where she stood on policy also set her against many of evangelicals' most deeply held commitments. But she was, in many ways, as a woman, as a feminist, and as somebody with this long history, quite possibly the worst candidate you could have run or put up against conservative evangelicals at the time.
So I know this is inviting speculation, but can you conceive of a woman candidate who could run again as the Democratic presidential nominee and win evangelical votes?
Well, I think I could, in part because you don't, not all evangelical votes, and not the conservative base, right? So in terms of you really, with elections as tight as they've been, you just need to peel off a very small percentage. And I think that there could be a woman who is positioned to do that, possibly somebody who doesn't carry the baggage that Hillary Clinton did. But maybe it's also somebody who's willing to take on these battles. And that's something that Clinton didn't seem all that willing or eager to do in the last election. You know, she was actually quite articulate about her own faith commitments, claiming her Christian faith. She spoke about the importance of her faith to her politics quite a bit on the campaign trail. But what she didn't do is she didn't kind of take on the evangelical framework worldview in their vocabulary, in their terms. She could have done that on issues of abortion, probably would not have gotten very far. Barack Obama didn't get very, very far with that. But I think religious freedom was a place where she possibly could have maybe peeled away just a bit and at least changed the narrative for some of the more moderate evangelicals. by not going there, I think she enabled the conservative spokespeople to really drive that narrative that she was an absolute threat to the religious liberty of American Christians. And I think that's something that did end up hurting her. But probably, I don't know, somebody, a younger generation, somebody who could speak the language of faith as Clinton did, but also utilizing a vocabulary that can then that can maybe break through some of the barriers. It could be possible, particularly, I think, with the younger generation. And that's where you see some more flexibility, I think some more openness to different ways of conceiving of a Christian politics.
Well, we have a couple more years before this all starts up all over again. And we'll have a chance to see what's happening with evangelicals in politics. Although one of my theories is that just the past few years has really shifted the way people are willing to self-identify with that label, and that we may be comparing apples to oranges when we get polling numbers in terms of how evangelicals are thinking and behaving in the next presidential cycle.
I think so. I think that the term itself is shifting. Those who are self-identifying with evangelical are now identifying with this right-wing political religious ideology more and more. And more of the moderates or progressives are finally coming to the conclusion that this is not who I am. This is not what I mean. And they're abandoning the term. So it will be hard to do a comparative analysis.
In my dreams, somebody would ask respondents whether they have ever identified themselves as evangelical.
Yes.
But that will remain in my dreams. Well, thank you so much, Kristen. This has been a great conversation. I'm so glad we could have you on.
Oh, thank you.
That's all for this special episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And until next week and the start of season 2, have fun storming the castle, kids.